Mesdames et messieurs, the greatest festival of our contemporary society, the Olympic Games, is about to begin. This is gonna be close.
Oh! They're all completely gassed! They've given it everything on the global bucket!
Oh, yeah! Oh! Oh!
Brilliant! 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 But that is an Olympic champion.
Ready?
Hello and welcome to another episode of Keep the Flame Alive, the podcast for fans of the Olympics and Paralympics. If you love the games, we are the show for you. Each week we share stories from athletes and people behind the scenes to help you have more fun watching the games. I am your host, Jill Jarrus, joined as always by my lovely co-host, Allison Brown. Allison, hello, how are you? Is there a reason we're saying singing the Marseillaise?
Because the torch has arrived in France.
That's exciting. We will talk about that.
We'll get to that later.
Yes, we'll get to that. We have a few announcements. First off, we want to give a shout out to our patrons and supporters who keep our flame alive. And our flame would totally go out if we didn't have your support. So thank you to those who donate money, support us in other ways. If you want to be an essential part of the show, please go to flamealivepod.com/support. Another big announcement, we're moving to two shows a week.
We're doubling in size, growing by 100%.
Yes, we have so much content from the Team USA Media Summit, and we've been doing follow-up interviews with some of the athletes who've had some time for us to delve really into their sports a little bit. So we are going to have shows dropping on Mondays and Thursdays. Thursdays will be our Olympic show and Mondays will be a Paralympic show because we have that many of each type of athlete. So I'm excited. And then we'll have news, but then hopefully the news segments will be shorter.
And the news from Paris is coming fast and furious.
So yes.
Going twice a week will make a lot of sense.
Yes. So this will be how it will be through the games. So we hope you are ready to come along for the ride. And I'm excited. We have some good interviews coming up.
And maybe I will sing on more shows.
Ooh la la. All right. Speaking of good interviews, Shukvastani Evan Dunphy is back. Evan won the bronze medal in Tokyo for the 50K race walk, and that race has been eliminated from the Olympic program for Paris. So Evan decided to switch to the 20K and do the mixed relay as well, which is the event they put in place of the 50K men's. Instead of adding a 50K for the women, they just did one individual race for everybody, one mixed relay. This decision for Evan to pop down to a different distance was not an easy decision or an easy path. We talked with him about he made the transition, his life outside of race walking, and how things are shaping up for Paris. Take a listen. Evan Dunphy, welcome back. We're so excited to have you back on.
I'm happy to be back on. It's so good to see you.
Realize we haven't talked since before Tokyo. So 3 years later-ish, how was Tokyo?
Tokyo was, I was saying this to someone yesterday. We were talking about, you know, what do you call it? Do you call it Tokyo 2020? Do you call it Tokyo 2021? And so I was saying how I look at the bronze medal that I won. And on that bronze medal, it says Tokyo 2020. And I just have to laugh because one, it was in 2021. And two, we raced in Sapporo. So really, the whole medal is a bit of a lie. The Olympic experience was obviously different with it being a COVID games, but the race itself was just phenomenal. It was the polar opposite for me from Rio, where I felt amazing and was off the front and was leading. And then I kind of stumbled at the end and finished fourth. And this time I felt like trash most of the way and just kept willing myself to stay up near the front and stay up near the front. And then somehow with that, in that last kilometer of the 50K walk, just somehow found it within myself in the 100th time of asking to find that next gear and being told 99 times by my body that I didn't have it. And on the 100th ask, it said, yep, yeah, go for it. And yeah, I was able to chase down the Spanish athlete and move into third place with about 150 meters to go of the 50K race and left hopefully an indelible mark on what was the last ever, you know, Olympic 50K, unfortunately.
What was Sapporo like? Was it hot?
you know, despite the efforts to move the marathons and the race blocks to Sapporo to avoid the heat, it was about the same temperature as Tokyo was, which was great for me. Like, I knew that my best chance of winning a medal was in really horrendous conditions. The most annoying thing, though, because race walking happens on a loop. So we're on a 2K loop. And there was a high-rise building that had one of those big LED screens on it that would sort of showcase the time and the temperature. And it was one of those ones where you don't want to know how hot it is. And you'd come around the corner and you'd be like, I don't want to look. And they would just catch it. Because the thing was like a story tall. You couldn't miss it. And so, you know, we started the race at 5:30 in the morning. So super early start time. And it was like 26, I think, something like that at the start. And so it was hot for 5:30, but bearable. But then every lap, like every 9 minutes, you come around that corner, you just see that thing ticking up 27, 28, 29, 30. Oh, man. That was just like, oh, like that added an element to it that was, you know, you're trying to do all this stuff to convince yourself it's not that hot. It's not that hot. And then you keep seeing that. And by the end of the race, it was 34, I believe, and about 80% humidity. And so I can't convert that into Fahrenheit quickly enough in my head, but it was hot and it was, you know, it definitely took its toll on the race. And you know, that's one of the big reasons why the athlete who finished fourth, Marc Tour of Spain, he had planned his race perfectly for 49.5K. And it was literally that last 500 meters that it just completely fell apart. And that's one of the amazing things about the 50K is that it can really come down to that tiny, tiny, tiny bit of a mistake. And, you know, you push yourself a little too much and that finish line becomes just too far away. And he was between 48 and 49K. He was moving faster than I was. And at 49K, he was 22 seconds ahead of me. And to think that was a gap that was, you know, that I was able to make up, I think it really does highlight and go to show like just how grueling the 50K can be if you don't plan it to a T.
So how do you plan for the heat? Because again, we're already starting to see Paris could be unbelievably hot.
So there's parts that you can do in your training. So, you know, making sure you're heat acclimated physiologically, that takes about 2 weeks. So making sure you're somewhere hot in that last 2 weeks of your prep, making sure that you're kind of getting that time in to get the body used to it and get those physiological changes that you want. There's the psychological element. I think Doha was probably the perfect example of that. We had our world champs there in 2019 and, you know, stinking hot for the race walks and the marathons. And you saw athletes, world record holder in the 50K race walk, Johan Deniz, like talking to the media beforehand. Oh, it's too dangerous. We shouldn't be racing and da 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 da. And doing 10K training sessions in his hotel, on his hotel floor of like 100 meter, doing 100 laps of 100 meters on his hotel floor because he didn't want to go outside. And he dropped out of the race 14K into the 50K at what would probably be his slowest training walk of the year. And I think it wasn't physiological, it was psychological. Whereas myself and a couple of other guys that I train with, we went into it thinking, this is going to be awesome. Like it's going to be so brutal and but people are going to do stupid things and we can take advantage of that. And when the gun went in Doha, I think I was probably like 4 or 5 meters behind the line, still chatting to one of my teammates, just completely oblivious to the fact that this race had started. Cause we knew we wanted to be right at the back of the race and just watch that first kilometer unfold to see from that first K, who got it wrong and who wasn't thinking about this. We saw athletes warming up in pants and you're just like, what are you doing? Like, why would you? But that's how I warm up. That's what warm up looks like. So I replicate that. Whereas I did a kilometer on the treadmill at the hotel before we left, went, okay, I still know how to race walk. Great. Went and had a cold shower and then went to the course and didn't race walk again until the race started. Just kept my core temp as low as possible, doing the ice baths and all that stuff. And so that final element is that what you do in the hours before the race and then during the race. So, you know, making sure that you're lowering your core temp by doing the ice bath and the ice vests and all that stuff. And then in the race, how much cold water can you pour on yourself? How much fluid can you consume? Tokyo, I drank about 4 liters of fluid in the 4-hour race. And so, yeah, just getting all those little things right can make the difference between getting to 49.5K and getting to 50K.
When you see a race unfold ahead of you, and you, what are the signs that you can tell people are probably going to drop out at some point?
There's some little ones of, you know, you see guys not taking on ice at the refreshment table or not pouring water over themselves. Stuff like that early in a race, even a race that's, you know, like Doha was hot the entire time, but even, you know, Sapporo where it was bearable for the first 10K. And so athletes were like, oh, okay, like don't need to worry about that sort of thing. And you could kind of just see, well, that, you know, that gives you the sense of, okay, that's going to come back and bite you in 20 or 30K. Sometimes you can look at the paces. And that's one thing that we were really lucky with. The women's marathon happened first in Doha. And one of our coaches that we work with went and plugged in all the data. And when we woke up the next morning, we had all the information of, okay, top eight were 10% off of their personal bests. So don't be surprised if you're 10% slower than your fitness tells you you can go. And 10% is huge. 10% is 30 seconds a kilometer. And so when that race started, I saw all these people going off at 5 minutes per K that have never walked 4:30s for a 50K. It was kind of like, okay, that's probably not going to work out for you. And so, you know, that you just take all the information that you can kind of get and pull that together to help sort of not so much make decisions, because you try not to make decisions based off what anyone else is doing, but to sort of give you confidence that, yeah, I'm in 25th spot right now, but we're only 20K into the race. And, you know, I still have confidence that I'm going to move up. And that's sort of where I was in Doha. I think I was back middle of the pack at halfway and just had that confidence of, yeah, no, this is where I need to be to get the result that I want. And, you know, ended up coming across the line in third in that one and picking guys off every kilometer that last 15K, which was a fun way to race. I got to say, that's a really fun way to do it.
It kind of baffles me because what, you're all elite athletes, so you all should be kind of at the top of your game, yet there's still some mental blockage that trips people up in situations like that. What's going on there? And so, or is it coaching that helps?
I think there's a lot of trail. I think there is an element of culture in it of, and you see this with, you know, a lot of the East African countries and their marathoners. They kind of do their slow shuffle warm up in their track suits, and that's just what you do. And so, you know, that there's very hard to get that to change. I think having Doha and Sapporo kind of back to back definitely helped shift some things in the endurance world within athletics to kind of see, at least I know for sure with the race walkers, like not as many people as I would have hoped saw what we did in Doha and the success that those of us who did those things had. And there were a few people who went, oh, okay, I need to learn what they did and try to replicate that. Why that lesson wasn't learned by everybody is kind of still wild to me. But, you know, certainly I think there's some of that coaching element, and not every athlete is lucky enough to have access to, you know, top physiologists or, you know, people who are clued into that world who can, you know, say, hey, this is what the research shows works. Even if it's just having that someone who's in the ear of a coach, because a lot of coaches are maybe stuck in their ways of this is how we do things. And it takes having that person who can kind of be in their ear and say, hey, like, hey, look at that. Like, look at what this research shows. Like, look at the potential that could be unlocked here. Even at the elite level, not every athlete is lucky enough to have that. So I think that's a big element of it as well.
It's kind of like a Moneyball situation. I don't know if you saw or read Moneyball. Yeah,
certainly. And I think that is a one way to think of it. I mean, for me, that's certainly an element of how I think about it when we have these hot races. I go into that saying, okay, I know I'm not the most physiologically gifted athlete on the start line. So we raced in perfect conditions. I think there's a lot of guys who would beat me just because they're genetically and physiologically more talented than I am. And so I reveled in having those hot conditions and really tough races, because it was sort of like, oh, I can level the playing, like doing all those little things right levels that playing field, which is, yeah, exactly, kind of, you know, the Moneyball analogy is perfect for that.
you mentioned something, and I've had questions in my brain about this. Knowing that there are other athletes that are genetically or physically, logically better than you on the start line, how do you think about that, or how do you process it when you all want to be the best?
Yeah, I think, I mean, certainly in the last sort of my like last 8 years for me, 8-9 years, I've been able to change my way of thinking that. I think when I was a younger athlete, there was that idea that being the best was the measure of success. Whereas I've sort of, you know, was very lucky to learn and have a great sports psych back in 2015 who kind of helped me transition away from that line of thought and more sort of towards the success is being your best. And I think that's, for me, what I can lean on is I take a lot of joy and pride out of the training of like seeing, okay, what am I capable of doing? And knowing that my best is competitive with some of the best in the world, and it might not be winning world championships, but it can be competitive. And if I have my best day, then I'll have a result that objectively is really good, but more importantly, subjectively, I can be really happy with. And, you know, that's really helpful. You know, world championships last year in Budapest, I came away with 2 fourth place finishes, which with a different mindset would be a lot harder to deal with, I think. Whereas, yeah, I'm hungry for more. I really wish I could have turned those into medals and been on that podium. But it's nothing that I've beaten myself up over in the months since or dwelled on too much, because it was the more or less the best I could have done on that day.
That also pumped something into my head that I hear on TV a lot, and I don't know if they do this in Canada, but you'll hear broadcasters say on sports things, they just wanted it more. And I just heard this in a women's college basketball game. This team just wanted it more. Does that even mean anything? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it makes no sense to me why somebody would say that, because how much wanting versus being able to perform, what's that balance?
That breeds so many interesting questions around. Last week, I went and spoke with our Junior B hockey team. They're in the playoffs right now and had some time off between their series, and they invited me to come out and just do a little talk and show them some race walking and just have some fun and do some team bonding. And one of the questions that one of the kids asked was around this idea of like ideal performance state, and how they were sort of saying like the way that they get really psyched up for a game is really different to how their teammates get psyched up for a game, and kind of asking, you know, what that looks like at the elite level. And it is interesting because I find you know, a lot of that, in a lot of sport, we've associated hype or sort of, you know, intensity as a measure of how tuned in someone is, how turned on they are, like how competitive they're willing to be or how hard they're willing to fight for it. When for some athletes, being calm, cool, joking, laughing, laid back, that's their ideal performance state. Like that's where they're going to get the most out of their body. And so I think part of me just feels like that just comes from such an outdated idea of ampedness, for lack of a better word, being associated with like desire, when that's just nonsense. I mean, you wouldn't look at, and it's sports specific, like we wouldn't look at golf and see, you know, a Happy Gilmore-esque athlete jumping up and down going wild, and we wouldn't say that that was, oh, they just, you know, they wanted it more. We'd say, oh, that was, you know, they were too psyched up and that's why they lost. Whereas in other sports we say, oh, like they were so psyched up, that's why they won. So it yeah, you're probably write an entire thesis on that.
Yeah, I know, because it boggles me. I just don't understand the thinking that desire is an element of making something happen. I mean, it is in a way, but just like, oh, on any given day, two teams or two athletes are playing their hardest, and the idea that wanting it more is what's going to push it over.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I think there is certainly there can be an element of that. You know, if there's higher pressure on one side, if, you know, I used to feel that way when I was playing hockey growing up as a kid, it was like, you know, I probably took it way more seriously than the other kids did, because it was like house hockey, and it was, and so I think there were some games where I like elevated my game simply because I cared more about it than any of the other kids did, probably to my detriment. But But I mean, I don't think that idea is like void of trueness, but it's certainly the way that we perceive want as kind of coming out or being shown, I think is like very culturally kind of dependent and probably outdated.
With Tokyo and getting the bronze medal, what opportunities came across from being a medalist that you didn't necessarily get from Rio beyond getting a lot of press from Rio?
Oh, none, really. You know, I have fewer sponsors now than I did before Tokyo. Not that I had many before Tokyo either. I think, yeah, not like life didn't really change a lot. Certainly there was a few more opportunities, sort of, you know, it gave me a good excuse to get back into the schools and actually have a medal to show all the kids. So the best thing about it is that medal has now been dropped and dinged and touched by, you know, held by probably 10,000 kids. So that was sort of an opportunity that's come out of it. That's been a lot of fun, and actually having that thing now that I can kind of say, you know, to a group of 10-year-olds, like, hey, when I was you sitting on that gym floor, this is what I dreamt of doing. And here it is. Like, it's real. It's tangible. You can hold it. And so hold it. And while you're holding it, think about, you know, what it is that you want to do with your life. And whatever that is, just if I can do this, there shouldn't be anything stopping you from chasing after that thing that you want to do. So in terms of like, The opportunities unlocked in terms of having really good metaphors have been fantastic. But from a career standpoint, not a whole lot. It was a very good tool. I ran for my local city council in 2022, and it was a great icebreaker because I was not super comfortable going around knocking on people's doors. But the medal provided a very good kind of icebreaker, if you will. And I actually had a couple of my friends who came out to help one day door knocking. And one of them's a Paralympic silver medalist. And her partner would just knock on doors and someone would answer and they'd like, yes. And like, would you like to see a Paralympic silver medal? And they'd be like, yes. And they'd look at it and like, wait, why are you at my door? Like, oh, right. Yeah. And we're campaigning on behalf of Evan Dunphy. And they were just so disarmed that it was kind of like, this was actually, it turned into a pleasant conversation rather than getting the door slammed in their face. So, you know, it can be a useful tool in that sense. But, you know, life is essentially carried on as it was, and which is fine because life was going pretty well before that medal as well.
Did you get a medal bonus from the Canadian Olympic Committee?
Yes. Yeah. So the Canadian Olympic Committee pays 10 grand for bronze, 15 for silver, and 20 for gold. And then we also have a program. So our main funding is what we call carding. And there's a top up to carding if you're ranked. So if you count the first year after the Olympics as sort of year one, there's a $5,000 bonus if you're ranked in the top five in the world in year one. Year two and three, if you're ranked in the top four, there's that, you know, you still get that bonus. And then in the Olympic year, you get the medal bonus if you win a medal. So it's kind of a very narrow pathway towards the medal of help. But what I find really, really funny is that $5,000 top up that you get in the non-Olympic years is tax-free, like our carding is. But the medal money is taxable income. And so the 5,000 you get in the, because I was, you know, going into the Olympics, I was ranked in the top four in the world. And so I had that bonus. And then after tax, the medal bonus wasn't much higher than the bonus for being fourth in the world the year before. It's one of those weird idiosyncrasies that I find quite strange.
Wait, where did the Kraft dinner sponsor? Where did that come in? Was that before or after?
So that was before Tokyo. Oh. And that was sensational. That was the coolest thing. I'm glad that we get to talk about that because that was such a cool thing. It was what I think must have happened was that Kraft Dinner, who they're a, you know, Canadian Olympic sponsor, Kraft is, and they must have gone to the Olympic Committee and said, hey, we want to do something with an athlete. and we want someone who this is going to be genuine for. We don't want to like go to their Instagram and see all these pictures of salads. And I'm pretty sure the COC immediately went, oh, we have the athlete for you. And so, yeah, so from our first conversation, they sort of said, they were very upfront of like what they wanted to do. And I said, you know, like, I think this is great. I appreciate that you want to use race walking as kind of this funny medium, because it's strange and it's kind of weird, but you're not making fun of race walking. And that was like right in my wheelhouse. I really appreciated that. So we sort of threw some ideas back and forth together. And I think they were really happy to kind of have that kind of space to, you know, not feel like they were offending me, that they had that space to have fun with it. And so, yeah, we did put this awesome, they did an amazing job with this commercial. And within all that, they saw how important it was for me to kind of use my platform to do good things. And they were kind of like, yeah, we can help. We have a very big platform and we can help with that. And so after the race in Sapporo and coming across the line and going to doping control and finally opening my phone for the first time, the first thing I saw when I opened Twitter was that Kraft Dinner donated. So I finished the race in 3 hours, 50 minutes and 50-ish seconds, I think, and saw that they had donated 35,050 boxes of Kraft Dinner to my local food bank. So that was like just incredibly cool to see me doing my silly little thing of walking fast pay off in something that huge. And then from that, they were like, hey, let's make a box with your face on it. And I sort of said, hey, can we auction those off for kids sport? And they're like, yeah, 100%. And we'll match it up to 10 grand. And so we ended up, you know, with people buying boxes of KD with my face on it, we raised 20 grand for kids sport. So more kids can get to play sport. And so that was the coolest partnership ever, just because they saw what was important to me and used the resources that they had available to them to amplify that. And so really, really cool. I'm pestering them to try to do something again before Paris, because I have what I think is a great idea. And I really, really want them to bite on it.
We will hope that happens again, because it was so much fun to follow. I will say that. And we were bummed that we could not get Kraft Dinner up in, I mean, we have mac and cheese, but we couldn't get Kraft Dinner. Mm.
We couldn't get here. The Canadian boxes with your face on it.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk.
Let's get down to 50K versus 20K. I realize you're probably thrilled with this decision. And you've done raced 20K before, but what's the differences in terms of building a strategy and technique?
I mean, the 50K, I like to describe the 50K as within the Olympics, it signified more than any other event what it means to endure. You know, it really, really underlined, and that was very visible. You could see that if you sat down and watched a race. It was enthralling. It's incredible how many people I've heard from over the years who would flat up tell me that they put the race on, thought, you know, this looks stupid, and then realized 5 minutes later that they couldn't turn it off, and they ended up watching the entire race because it does pull you in, it captivates you, and you find out they're going how far, and you're like, oh man, like, and then you start seeing, oh, this athlete's 3 minutes ahead, but like they're losing 30 seconds every lap. And, you know, this athlete's on the sidelines throwing up and whatever else is coming out of wherever else. And, you know, I just don't think the 20K can do justice to that. And the fact that it's walking, you know, race walking, it needs to have something that legitimizes it. And I think the fact that it was the furthest foot race in the Olympics, it made sense for it to be race walking because it was far. It was this in you know, ability to endure. And so I just don't think that the 20K has that same capability of captivating. And I also think it's really tough to judge. You know, I have very strong opinions on how bad the judging's been the last several years and athletes getting away with absolutely, like in my mind, pretty terrible technique, which that part of it we're getting closer and closer to solving with technology coming in that hopefully will be ready in time for LA that will measure flight time and sort of take that subjective element out of it. So that's one thing that is good. So that's sort of the philosophical how I feel about the event. In terms of the physiological sort of training for it, it's they're completely different events. And annoyingly, World Athletics replaced the 50K with a 35K at World Champs. So we have a 20K and a 35K at World Champs. And we've seen from the two World Championships that we had, the same guys and girls doing well at each because they're the same event. You know, the 35K is a 20K with just an extra 15K at the start. Whereas the 50K was a completely different beast, different training, different physiological requirements, different ability to utilize carbohydrates and fuel and hydrate yourself that made it more of a sort of science experiment than a foot race. So yeah, so I think that those things are all very different, and I hated the 20K, and I thought that my career was essentially going to be over after Tokyo and that I would stick around for a little bit, but mentally I'd be a bit more checked out and you know, finding as many soft landing spots and parachutes as I could for when sport comes to an end for me. And then I went and broke the national record and got my first PB in 9.5 years and finished fourth at World Championships and was like, oh, I guess I've actually figured this event out. And I got to say the last 8 months have been a lot more fun and I'm enjoying it a lot more and feeling like I actually have a chance at still unlocking some of that potential that I think I have, and which is a fun place to be. I think I had spent a year kind of resigned to the fact that I wasn't going to unlock new potential in this event. And that was a pretty mentally tough space to be in. And so, yeah, the last 8 months, it's been fun, which is, I didn't think I was going to say.
Did the results change your mindset or did the mindset change the results?
I think it's a little bit of both. Certainly getting to St. Moritz in Switzerland, where we do our altitude training last summer before games, because 2022, our world champs were in Eugene. I didn't go anywhere before them. I didn't even, you know, I wasn't even there for the 20K. I watched 20K on TV at home before taking the short flight out from Vancouver to the race 35K. So 2022, I felt very disconnected and my mind was way more attached to the election than it was to world champs. And 2023 sort of started the same way, although there was a lot more borderline depression and stuff around not getting elected and coming so close in the election and coming up short left me in a pretty tough mental space for the first few months. And so finally got away and got to Europe with a couple of the guys that I was training with. And that's when it sort of started to click of like, oh yeah, like this actually can be fun. And I get to see my friends and get to train with people, which I hadn't done in earnest since, you know, in a really long time. And so that started to kind of, I think going into that race, going into the race in Budapest at World Champs, I was already starting to feel a little bit different. And then probably, you know, I definitely am someone who lacks confidence without results. I kind of need those results to like give me the confidence to like, oh, okay, that was possible, I guess. And so going into the race, I was feeling happy and content and excited, but I think the result help solidify that like I still have an opportunity to do something special in this event.
What are the sort of things you think about strategically versus in the 20K versus the 50K?
So the 20K is much more, and the world champs in Budapest were an anomaly because the race from the gun went stinking fast and I finished fourth with a pot, like my second 10K was a couple seconds slower than my first 10K and that's not normally how that race unfolds. Normally it's sort of a 15K feeling, you know, you got to get to 15K feeling good. And then the top eight is whoever can go the fastest over the last 5K. So it's a lot more change in pace, a lot more how I like to describe it is the 50K is you kind of get to a level of hurt and you just try to hold on to that same level for as long as you possibly can. Whereas the 20K is sort of, you get to a level of hurt and then you try to push beyond that a little bit, hurt a little bit more, and then you try to hurt a little bit more and try to hurt a little bit more. And that kind of that hurt ramps up rather than sustaining that lower level of hurt for just a really long time. And I think I've always been more comfortable in that space of like, let it hurt and then just like live in that space for a few hours. And so for training wise and tactics wise, like getting used to and learning and improving on that change of pace and ramping up of the hurt and going into that anaerobic area has been what I've had to work on the most in terms of transitioning to the 20K.
Has your body changed?
I mean, I'm also getting old, which is, you know, for my sport. So I think there's some changes there, but like for the most part, you know, I've been dealing with a pretty aggravated hamstring now for 4 or 5 years, but it's under control and it's probably in the least pain it's been in a really long time. And so that's really nice. And, you know, I did unfortunately tear my hamstring in the 35K race in Budapest with about 2.5 kilometers to go. So that was really frustrating because I was closing in on third place and might have maybe possibly had an outside chance to catch them and then heard a pop and managed to get myself to the finish line somehow, which I was very proud of because this is going to sound silly, but I always sort of thought, like, I was like, I think I might be a bit of a wimp. Like, you know, because you see guys, and this is something that this is really interesting because you see guys like at the end of it, Perseus Karlström is one of my guys I train with from Sweden. And he's one of those guys that you can hear him when you watch his race on TV and you can hear him breathing. Like, it's one of those guys that you can see like, oh, he's really, really working hard. Like, he is killing himself. He's turning himself inside out to get to that finish line. And then when I watch myself race, I kind of see like, I don't really feel like my facial expression changes very much. And I always think like, oh, was I just not willing to push myself harder and all these sorts of things. And then in that race, it was kind of like, oh no, like actually, like, yeah, you are tough. like it was, and then there was this awkward moment after where I was like, well, I really hope it's torn. like, you know, you don't, ideally for training, not torn would have been great. But also I was like, well, if it's not torn, then I kind of lose this ability to think that I'm tough. and so that presented a very strange dynamic in my brain for a little while there.
Okay, I can't miss this. Your muscle tears, how do you physically keep going? Because I've torn a muscle and I just crumbled to the floor. I'm obviously nowhere near an athlete, but like that's your body's natural reaction. How do you fight that natural reaction to just fall over and keep going?
It started with swearing a lot. There was a lot of yelling to no one in particular. And then I think adrenaline kicked in because there was probably 500 meters of excruciating pain, kind of not sure I was going to be able to finish. And then thinking, wow, okay, like it's 2K. I can probably like hobble to the finish line. And like the goal at that point was to like, you know, if I could still maybe salvage a top eight, eighth would be $4,000. Okay, that would be kind of, I'd be nice. Like, so just keep going until you're in ninth. And then then you can drop to the ground. And then it kind of spent the next 500 meters was like, okay, no one's catching me. Okay, this doesn't hurt quite as much now. And then I actually picked up a little bit in the last kilometer and was able to kind of almost get back on pace. And then I accidentally made my mom cry because my physio was putting a wrap on afterwards just to kind of hold everything together. And she went and just like touched the back of my hamstring, like just with like, you know, a soft little like to put that tape on. And I guess my mom was in front of me and I like winced and that was too much for her. So that was, to me, that was kind of like, oh yeah, okay, this is probably like natural. This is probably not great. And then I got COVID and then, yeah. So the whole end of that trip was not quite as great as the start of it was, I gotta say.
So last time we talked about what goes through your head for 50K. What's different for 20?
Everything happens really quick. And so in the Budapest race was interesting because we were 2 hours delayed. So we're in the call room. We're about to go out to that to start the race. Person makes an announcement. We all think, okay, this is the announcement to like go out to the course. And then the announcement is there's lightning. Come back in an hour and a half, basically. Basically, you know, the race delayed 2 hours and you go back to the tents. And so I just remember kind of being like, okay, nothing I can do about that. And then everyone around me freaking out. And as we're walking out, I turned to Percy and sort of said, well, like, this is our advantage. Like, we're, you know, we'll go back to our rooms. We'll relax. We'll do whatever we need to do. We'll get some food in us. And we're just going to come back and say, everyone else freaking out about this, it's going to negatively affect them more than it's going to affect us. And we'll use that as an advantage. Little did I know at that point in time, Percy was also freaking out and sort of said to me afterwards that like that. He's like, oh, yeah, thank you for saying that. But so that was like, it felt really relaxed at that point in time. And then we go into the race and the gun goes. It's still, the course is soaking wet. There's puddles everywhere. That first kilometer was almost just figuring out which part of the course, you know, which part of the loop could you walk on and not just be in a puddle the entire time. And then the race went out so fast. And I just remember I was maybe three or four seconds back after the first couple K and just being like, oh, good, I got to go catch those guys. Like, I got to be up there. And I, so the next like 3K, all I could think about was just, I'm working really hard to catch up to these guys. I wasn't thinking about anything other than just like, okay, get back on the front of this race, get back on the front of this race. And then kind of got back on the front of the race. And that was kind of like, okay, I can relax now. And the pace was still stinking fast, but I felt like, okay, job was done. I did what I needed to do. I got myself back on that group. I didn't let them get away. And now I can just chill here and let other people do the work for the next 15K. And at 10K, we went through 10K and we were 39 minutes. And Chris Linke was beside me and we looked at each other and went, are we really that fast? Like, this is very fast. Or it was kind of like, okay, I guess we're going this fast. And then the last 10K, I don't really remember. Like after that point, I'm just like, I don't really remember much. You're fighting to hang on to the front of that group and stay there as long as you possibly can. Whereas the 50K, I still, you know, there's lots of it you don't remember, but the feelings of the tactics of, okay, trying to stay relaxed, stay calm, slowly make your move. If you're catching a guy, like you don't need to catch them all at once, that sort of thing. The 20K is very much just like react to every move. Always like if someone makes it, you know, gets a step on you, close that gap right away. You're just way more conscious of those things than in a 50K where you're kind of racing your own race. The 20K, you're kind of racing everyone's race.
Do you do anything to train for reactions?
Not a whole lot. Yeah. Not, you know, I had this fascinating conversation one time. Myself, Marco Arup, our world champion 800 meter runner, and Mo Ahmed, Olympic silver medals in the 5K. We were all doing a school talk together and talking about our process and talking about that stuff. And you know, it was so fascinating. You know, he had a 800 meter guy, a 5-10K guy, and a 50K guy. And all of the things we were talking about were the exact same. Just the amount of time between those decisions was so radically different. And so Marco's talking about these fractions of a second that he has to react to something and make a decision and all this stuff. And Marco and Mo's talking about, see a guy make a move and then you have to decide whether or not, you know, you get that moment to decide, do I go with it or not? And then you have to make that decision. And then for me, it's like, you see a guy make a move, you let him see how that move plays out for a little bit, and then you can kind of figure out if you react to it or not. But yeah, for hearing for, you know, someone like Marco, like how much more important it is to have those reflex, because they're reflexive rather than reactive. Whereas I think for me, like even in the 20K, they're still reactive decisions. They're still this decision that if you have a good plan, if you have the right plan, if you kind of know roughly what you're hoping to do and how you're going to react to those moves, you can kind of still have that time to sort of say, okay, yeah, this is happening. Checklist. Okay, this is what I'm supposed to do. If that happens, okay, go and do that. Whereas Marco has to do that reflexively. That has to be drilled into him so that he knows as soon as that thing happens, his body just has to respond to it.
What do the next 4 months look like for you?
So I'm heading to Europe to race in Czechia in April, and then being very selfish and staying. We have a race 2 weeks later in Turkey. It's our world team championships. And so I'm going straight from Czechia to Turkey to train with Percy and Nick Christie, one of the Americans, for 2 weeks there. And so that was a really tough thing because it means I'm missing coaching. I'm coaching the University of British Columbia Racewalkers now. It means not being here for a couple of the boards I sit on now. So I'm on the board of the food bank, and I'm on the board of our local kids sport chapter. And so it means missing those things. And so it's tough. It's had to be that, like, no, like, I need to put everything into this now. I need to be selfish one last time, you know, leave no stone unturned. And so trying to still convince myself that that is okay and allowed. Team championships, I'll hopefully be racing with one of the girls that I'm coaching, Olivia Lundman, and we're going to take a stab at qualifying for the event that's replaced the 50K, the mixed team relay. So marathon relay, one guy, one girl, you take two legs each of roughly 10K. And yeah, so we'll take a shot at that. It'd be super amazing to qualify for that. Was telling Jill before we started recording that at the Olympics, we have a 72-hour rule, so we're out of the village within 72 hours. I compete on day zero of athletics, and so that would mean missing, you know, not getting to really see any of my teammates compete. The relay is a week later, so very, very selfishly, I really want to qualify for that relay so that I can stay in the village and get to, you know, cheer on my teammates and get some of that, you know, get that experience one last time. And also, I'd love for Olivia to get that experience so that she can take that to LA and hopefully be in the individual 20K in LA and it not be this big, scary, daunting thing. It'll be old hat, knows what to expect. So really, really hopeful that we can qualify there. And then May, back home, doing some coaching duties and all that stuff. And then June, take off for altitude, do our month in St. Moritz, do our 2 weeks in Barcelona, getting acclimatized to the heat, and then into Paris. It's very formulaic at this point in time. We know exactly where we're going to be staying in St. Moritz. We know all of our training loops. We know how long the train takes from Zurich and all that stuff. So many of those elements are controlled now, and we know exactly what to expect. And so that makes things like so much easier in terms of just focusing on the training and all that stuff. So yeah, really excited for that. Bittersweet, because it might be the last time I'm ever in St. Moritz, which is, you know, my favorite place on earth. It's where I got engaged last summer, which was really, really exciting. And so, you know, my partner will come and join me once the school year is done and she's done teaching, and we'll kind of get to revel in that place that neither of us will never be able to afford to go back to once sport is over, and then just go on to Paris and leave it all on the course and see what we can do.
The element of selfishness is inherent just in elite sport or in a lot of elements of sport. How has that changed during each of your quads?
Really, it's so interesting because when I was heading into Rio, I was doing this for myself. You know, it was, I wanted to know how good I could be, and that was kind of it. Obviously, I had a team around me, but there was not much outside influence, I guess. And I think that's exemplified by in that final 5 kilometers as I was chasing down Hiroki in third place, I was telling myself, just take one more step, just take one more step. It was this really internal, me-focused thing. And then Rio unfolds the way it does. I have all these opportunities once getting involved with kids sport, doing all these school talks, all the stuff that I never thought I would have as a race walker. And so fast forward to Tokyo, and I'm still doing it for myself and that, but I also have this kind of community behind me, and there's all these people that I feel like are a part of the journey as well. And I think that's exemplified in that final kilometer in Tokyo, where instead of thinking, just take one more step, just take one more step, the thing that unlocked that 100th time of asking, you know, do I have one more gear? It was thinking of all the people back home that were walking every step with me. That thought process, that was so much more external than it was in Rio, where it was this really internal thought. And so having those two moments within the race that kind of exemplify how those quads had changed, how I had changed, and how kind of my motivations, my whys had changed. I think it's really cool to have those two kind of like really succinct, obvious points that I can look at and say, yeah, look at how much this has changed. And, you know, now heading into Paris, I think there's a little bit of a change in that because I've kind of taken that idea of having that community behind me, and I've taken more of my time to apply the ideas of giving back to my community outside of sport. So I'm on these boards. I'm you know, I'm doing these things that aren't just me trying to do good things by walking fast. And so, you know, it'll be really interesting to see how that manifests in Paris and how that evolution sort of continues and what that looks like beyond Paris. Because Paris is almost certainly my last Olympics. Almost certainly. And but I still want to go to World Champs in 2025 and go back to Tokyo and actually have a crowd there and race in Tokyo that I, you know, that I didn't get to do and all that stuff. So it certainly isn't the end of the end, but it will be my, you know, likely my last Olympic experience. So it's exciting. It's exciting to see what that will look like and how I'll feel and how that will all manifest itself on race day.
We may have been screaming at the television.
Yeah, right?
During Tokyo.
It is remarkable how many stories I've heard from. It must have been a long weekend, I think, at home, because I've heard from tons of people who were huddled around a phone while they were camping and having entire campsites that had congregated around because they'd start yelling about something. And people are like, oh, what are you guys watching? And all of a sudden, there's 40 people huddled around a phone screen. And it's really been so cool to hear those stories and to hear the memories that people have from that. And I have video of all of my friends watching back home in that moment when they're all yelling at the TV to go back to the race because they're showing the guys come across the line in first and second. And then the camera kind of pans up slowly after Jonathan finishes in second. And you can kind of see my shoes and the moment that all my friends sort of lose their mind. And there was boxes of Kraft dinner being opened and flung into the air. And my friend's dog was still getting Kraft dinner out of the cracks in the concrete weeks later. But just having that, getting able to see that and having that look at things, I think it's so much more special than being able to rewatch the race, which I've rewatched the last, you know, kilometer, but I've never rewatched the whole race. I'm sure there's parts of it that I would just be baffled by if I went back to watch again and that I'd just completely been lost to from my memory.
Spoiler alert, you won a medal.
Now that you have more of a name in Canada, do you feel any different kinds of pressure in terms of expectation or do you have a system for dealing with that?
I mean, I think if I was getting paid more, I might feel like I had more pressure on me. At this point in time, it's sort of like, if I don't win a medal, I'm not going to lose sponsors. So I think that would be the only thing, you know, if I had sponsorships that were incentivized where I got bonuses if I performed well and stuff like that. That's the only way in which I could see that I could have more external pressure. I think I put enough internal pressure on myself. But externally, I think at the end of the day, there's just not enough. It's still race walking at the end of the day. I think that's the way to sum it up, is that I think people are really happy to see me do well, but it's no one is hinging their ride on me, so to speak. So yeah, maybe there. I did hear from someone after Tokyo who said, or after Rio, who said they put a little bit of money on me. And in the moments that I was the bronze medalist, got paid out, and they were very happy about that. So, you know, maybe there are a couple people out there who are hinging money on me, and hopefully don't want to come breaking my legs if I don't win a medal for them.
Are you running for office again?
Certainly, yeah. I like to describe it as, you know, in Rio, I was fourth. I was just off that podium. You know, I used that motivation to come back a better athlete the next one around and got on that podium. And this time around, I was 400 votes out. I was just outside, just off the podium. And so want to learn from that experience and come back stronger the next time and hopefully, again, get myself on that podium and get elected. So certainly want to run again. It was a ton of fun, learned so much, and really think I'd be good at that job.
When is election season?
2026.
Okay. That's what
It's just like the last 16 or so years of my life. It's just another career where I'd be planning my life in 4-year cycles. that feels fitting.
Something you're familiar with.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you running for Athletes Commission?
No, I've toyed with it. I've been asked about it. I think for me, the passions that I have, the good things I want to do just aren't really in the sport world anymore. You know, I want to help build good cities. I'm more energized by that and excited by that. It's just more invigorating to me now than sport. And I think we have some amazing people who are doing, especially in Canada. I think we're blessed in Canada to have probably the best athlete commission in the world, but also a National Olympic Committee that listens to them and gives them space. And you know, so I think we're in good hands, sports in good hands. That does remind me of a story that I feel like you guys would love to hear.
Yes.
So back in Tokyo, the medal ceremony is back in the Olympic Stadium in Tokyo. So we're flown back to Tokyo and we're waiting there to get our medals, and our medals are being presented by two executive board members of the IOC. And so I'm thinking, perfect. These are the people that got rid of this event, and they're going to have to look at me. I'm going to have like a couple of seconds where they're going to have to listen to me. So I'm going to use that time to speak my truth. And so you grab the medal off the plate and you put it on yourself, which was really nice. They didn't, you know, because of COVID, they didn't get to put the medal on me. I got to put the medal on myself, which didn't realize it at the time, but ended up being something that was really important to me. And just said to them, you know, you made a terrible mistake getting rid of this event, and I hope you have to live with that decision for the rest of your life. And came off the podium and went upstairs. And the first person I saw from the COC was David Schumacher, our CEO. And just sort of said, hey, David, just by the way, I said this just in case you hear anything. And sure enough, the next day, find out that the IOC had filed a complaint against me because they had felt disrespected. And I kind of replied, well, yeah, that, how do you think I feel? And sort of said, you know, that was, you know, the most respectful way I could have protested. I was wearing a mask. No one else, you know, it was a conversation between the two of us. It wasn't anything bigger than that. And so, yeah, that's kind of where I thought it was going to end. And then I found out that the COC, Canadian Olympic Committee, apologized on my behalf. And so then I had to have a conversation in the airport with our president and sort of say, I really wish he hadn't done that. I'm not sorry. And, you know, I feel pretty disrespected for someone apologizing on my behalf. But yeah, it was awesome. It was great to get to that moment to speak my truth. Our press conference after the race was remarkable. Myself, David and Jonathan getting the chance to talk about what it meant having the event taken away from us. And those quotes never went anywhere, but they made an impact in that room. And very annoyingly, they wouldn't let Jonathan and David answer in their own language. They made them answer in English, which was incredibly frustrating because they couldn't find the exact words to express how they felt about it. But it was cool to see three athletes on that had just finished on the podium of this event speak so passionately and defensively about what their event means and meant and the good that will be lost by not having it was really, really special. So, you know, those are moments that no one really got to see. But when I look back on the experience, they're up there in terms of what I'm proud of alongside, just as high alongside the race.
Evan, well, thank you so much for coming back on the show and spending a ton of time with us.
Yeah, of course. I love this.
We're excited that you get to go to Paris. We're excited that we will get to see you and try not to be crazy on the sidelines.
Yeah, it'll be a lot of fun. You'll have to find, I'll have a big group there. My fiance is going to be there and all my family. So you have to find them and stand with the Canadian cheer squad.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Evan. You can follow Evan on Insta and X. He is at Evan Dunphy.
Are you heading to Paris this summer?
Oui, oui.
Will you go see some race walking past the Arc de Triomphe?
Oui, oui. And I will be looking for Evan's family in their lovely Lululemon outfits.
And for you and for everyone who's heading over to Paris, you can keep all your memories saved in our new travel journals. We have one for the Olympics and one for the Paralympics. And we will be coming out with one for those who are staying home as well. So a television watching journal. And these handy notebooks have checklists, writing prompts, and travel tips. So you can record all your favorite moments from your once-in-a-lifetime trip. And the travel journals are available on Amazon.com. You can find them through links on our homepage, flamealivepod.com.
And I'm excited. I have my own copies of the travel journals, and they are nice. They are really cool. I'm excited to use them.
I'm very excited as well. I haven't seen them in person. C'est magnifique.
Yes, so the torch has arrived. The ship, the Belle M, arrived in Marseille. I have not seen the footage yet. Did you?
It's a nice fancy ceremony, and Tony S. Dengue showed up. It's what you would expect. It has all the pomp and the circumstance, and Tony S. Dengue is there, and you heard lots of music and lots of French flags, and it was real. And the day was beautiful. They could have dialed in better weather.
Excellent. So the big news was that they released a cauldron for the torch relay.
Right. And it's a cauldron, though it is a small version. So this cauldron is going to be used in stopover cities around France. So there's 20 of them that were produced. And it gives me great hope for what we're going to see at the end of the torch relay, that we will get a real cauldron. There was a press release from Paris 2024. And this was also designed by, I'm going to get the name wrong because I have not been doing enough Duolingo, Mathieu Lehenoir, who was the same designer as the torch. It uses that same metal in a ring.
Nice.
It has three supports. So it's when it's lit, it's supposed to look like it's floating.
Oh, cool.
And the reflective metal base has that same wave ripple effect. So it'll look like fire floating on water.
Oh, that's very cool. I mean, the picture you posted in the Facebook group, to me, it almost looks like the waves are photoshopped in, that wavy metal. It looks weird from the angle that they took the picture. I will say that, but I bet it's
base
cool.
Is reflective.
Oh.
So depending on what light you shine on it, because I saw a picture where it almost looked green because they were taking a picture of it outdoors.
Oh, cool.
And you could see the trees and thing reflective in it. But here's the coolest part about that wave effect. It was actually made by water.
Oh, really?
I don't quite understand the process. It's called hydroforming. So they heat the metal that it is and like use a wave machine.
Oh, really? Oh, that is cool. That is really cool. So the water then makes the dips. And so I would imagine that no two cauldrons are alike.
I would expect so.
Very, very
This
cool.
is what they use at the end. So much better than the snow flame.
Almost anything is going to be better than the snow flame. I'm very hopeful about this. Also, did you hear this? That the music has come? I'm so glad you have not listened to this. So the official theme music has arrived as well. This is the music that they are playing along the torch relay. This is also the music that they will play in venues. Ad nauseum, so expect this to get in your head. I would not be surprised if this is also music that you will hear on the OBS feeds. So hold on to your hats, people. Let's take a listen to this. is so fantastic.
I was with it, with its Disney musical overture, and then we hit the disco beat.
It is that. Oh, composers Victor Lamesne. I'm blown away by this. This is an earworm that will get in our heads, much like the Beijing music got in my head, although I can't remember any of it anymore.
But if you heard it, you would have an immediate Pavlovian reaction.
Yes, right. But the transition from, yes, Disney music to choral and then to Hooked on Classics Olympics. Oh my gosh. This is
amazing.
Fantastic. With the, I love the throwback to Hooked on Classics type style with the teal and the pink of the design of these games. Oh my gosh. We are just going right back there.
So a few Christmases ago, my daughter bought me a Team USA sort of papery jacket from 1996. She found it on eBay. I think that's coming with me.
Yes!
It'll be Hooked on Classics in front of the Eiffel Tower. Oh, that's going to be fun. That is fun. I am really loving the look and sound.
Oh my gosh, it's just going to... Oh. There's something so French about it to me, something so throwback about it to me, and it's also a little hilarious.
Excellent. Nice job, Victor. Oh, let's go get some coffee together.
Yes. So, it's fabulous. That giant rainwater storage basin, what a segue.
Well, going back to the water discussion.
Yes, there we go. The giant rainwater storage basin is done. It was done on time. It will be able to hold 20 Olympic swimming pools worth of dirty water that will now be treated instead of just going into the river. So hopefully this will help with the Sen water is too dirty to swim in issue.
Fingers crossed. Exactly. Triathlon and marathon swimming will be in the Sen as intended.
Exactly. We always have our job or officiating role we would want during the Olympics and Paralympics. Would not want this job, but I will probably be awake for it, is during the games, the water will be tested at 3 a.m. every day.
I would love that job.
Oh, yeah?
There are test tubes involved and like mixing. There's probably pH sticks.
Probably. Maybe we can work on that for you. We have some World Games news. We need some music for World Games. We'll work on that. That's a 20.
Do, 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 do. Do, 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 do.
World Games has announced that the World Games 2029 host city will be Karlsruhe, Germany. And it is the first city to organize the World Games twice. So games are going back to Germany. That will be very exciting. Maybe we'll go.
Well, you speak German, so yeah, I feel safe traveling with you there.
Well, you got through China and I didn't speak Chinese. So.
Welcome to Shook Flistan.
It is the time of the show where we check in with our team, Keep the Flame Alive. These are past guests of the show and listeners who make up our citizenship of Shook Flistan, our very own country. First up.
At the World Aquatic Artistic Swimming World Cup event in Paris, Jacqueline Simoneau and partner Audrey Lamont won bronze in the duet technical and duet free. Canada finished second in the team free. And Jacqueline reported that the venue, which will be the artistic swimming venue for the Olympics, is gorgeous.
Nice. And that is one of like two brand new stadiums that they built specifically for the games. So very, very cool. Boccia player Allison Levine and partner Ilion Chibanu won silver in the BC4 pairs division of the Montreal World Boccia Cup.
Stephanie Roble and Maggie Shea are sailing in the 2024 European Championships, May 7th through the 12th in Le Grand Mont.
Pole vaulter Katie Moon is still struggling with the injury to her Achilles, and she has withdrawn from the Doha Diamond League event. She plans to return for the Prefontaine Classic at the end of May.
Lauren Gibbs has published The Medalist Mindset, the workbook, Your Guide to Success at the Highest Level, written with fellow Olympian Shannon Robery.
And congratulations to our friend Rich Perlman, who won fifth place at the 2023 AIPS Sports Media Awards for writing best column with his entry,
with the best of intentions, the IOC has lost its way. And we will link to that in the show notes so that you can enjoy it as well. And that is going to do it for this episode. Let us know what you think of the new race walking mixed relay.
You can find us on X, YouTube, and Instagram at Flame Alive Pod. Send us an email at flamealivepod@gmail.com. Call or text us at 208-352-6348. That's 208-FLAME-IT. Chat with us and other fans on our Facebook group, Keep the Flame Alive Podcast, and sign up for our weekly newsletter with even more Olympic and Paralympic info at our website, flamealivepod.com.
Don't forget, next week we are moving to 2 shows a week, and Monday will be our Paralympic show with shot putter Noelle Malkamaki. She is so much fun, so we cannot wait to share this interview with you. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, keep the flame alive.